The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. My name is Bok Shu. What is reality? What is not reality? I don't know what reality is or what it is not, but I think we're all here because of reality. Why do I say that? Because there is no one on this earth who does not suffer. And that suffering, while it must not be confused with reality, is undeniably located in our relationship to reality. Or rather, it is located in our not understanding our relationship to reality. And isn't that the reason we're all here, to clarify our relationship to reality? If we can't relate to reality, I think we're in trouble. And we really do actually seem to be in trouble, just in case you haven't cracked open a newspaper lately. So you may call clarifying your relationship to reality something else, but slapping a different label on the venture that you are hazarding here today does not alter the reason that you are here. Do you wish you had a different husband or boyfriend? Do you have a job you dislike? A debt you cannot repay? A president you cannot begin to believe? Or do you not have something without which you feel incomplete, such as not having a girlfriend or being unemployed? I don't have a boyfriend or a job, and I cannot begin to believe our president or what's going on in this country. But my presence here has nothing to do with those issues. My difficulties with reality lie elsewhere. What about you? Admittedly, I could be completely wrong about why you're here. Maybe you're here to become a better person, as you call it, or calmer, as you call it, or what you call happier. Still, I don't see how any of those fall outside the sphere of your relationship to reality. As a species, we are quite obstinate in failing to understand this vital relationship, and because of our obstinacy, we suffer, all of us. So what is our relationship to reality? The answer is blindingly simple. It is us. It is us. Reality is all of us, throughout all space and time, right now. We, everyone and everything right now, we are the one great, immeasurable reality in a constant state of flux. There is nothing left out, nothing that is separate from anything else. There is nothing that is fixed, and we are intimately connected to it all the time. It is not a contradiction for me to say that I do not know what reality is or is not, and at the same time to declare that everyone and everything is reality. After all, I have eyes and I am just as blind as the next person when it comes to seeing the totality of everything throughout all space and time. If by some wild fluke I were to catch a glimpse of that totality, how could I possibly express it to you now? So when I say that our suffering is located in our relationship to reality, I mean that we do not want to accept reality as it is. We do not want to accept that reality is us. And the manifestation of our lack of acceptance is that we want things to be different than they are. Always. And even when reality winds up accommodating our preferences, by then our preferences have changed, like magic. So we wanted something different, we got the different thing, but different became different. It changed, yet again. Different is never different enough. Reality never catches up with our preferences. But that is not its job. Reality has no job. It is gainfully unemployed, ceaselessly working just as it is. Who told us things would work out the way we want them to? When were we issued the money-back guarantee that went along with our lives? I definitely want things to be different. Not a day goes by when my desire to have a reality different than the one I've got doesn't rear its head. And I'm drowning in privilege. So it's pretty pathetic if you really want to look at it. And so this talk of mine is really the blind leading the blind. And the proof of that is in our study text for this summer and fall practice period, the Vimalakirti Sutra. And on page 70 of Burton Watson's wonderful translation of that sutra, we read, "As the Buddha has said, if one is in bonds himself, to suppose he can free others from their bonds is hardly reasonable. But if one himself is free of bonds, it is perfectly reasonable to assume he can free the bonds of others." Well, first of all, I'm hardly qualified to declare myself to be free of bonds. If I declared myself free of bonds, that would be the greatest evidence you could have of my bondage, my attachment to being without bonds. Freedom doesn't come because we want it. If we attach to something we call freedom, seeing it as being separate from ourselves, then we're really bound hand and foot. Why should we want something that is inherently ours from the beginning? And again, the Buddha said, if one is in bonds oneself, to suppose he can free others from their bonds is hardly reasonable. Well, my response to that is, who cares? Who cares what's reasonable? Have you ever described your experience as being a reasonable experience? Can you think of anything more tepid and shallow than a reasonable experience? And do you think the Buddha cared about people having reasonable experiences? And yet here he is quoted as saying, it is hardly reasonable that someone flawed could ever help another flawed person. I think the Buddha is being quoted here ironically, like a hipster in Williamsburg wearing polyester pants. When I think something is unreasonable, it's a sure sign that I'm not relating skillfully to reality. I'm not getting what I want, and so I think it's unreasonable, the person or the situation. I walk around thinking I've got the definition of reasonable, thinking I can define reasonable versus unreasonable, but I can't. My use of reasonable to order my perspective on reality is completely unreasonable and unreasoned. It is disordered. Now, I'm not saying that we should abandon or suppress our opinions or ignore our own ideas about human behavior. This is really where it gets juicy. what we think is constantly at odds with some aspect of reality, but we do actually have to function in this world. And we cannot function in this world without opinions and ideas. This world of suffering, this world of right and wrong and good and bad. So our challenge is, can we use our discernment to function in this world of right and wrong and good and bad and immense, constant, endless suffering and not turn our ideas and opinions into Olympian gods that we bow down and worship? None of us is the keeper of the flame of truth. We can function in this world with our opinions, but we do not have the truth individually. The challenge of having my opinions while not turning my opinions into Olympian gods is something I struggle with constantly. I make no pretense of being free, but I am free of any concern that it might be unreasonable for me, in my bondage, to try to help you free yourself from bondage. Why? Because my antics are so ridiculous that I can't help but illuminate a better way of living for you. When I recount for you the way my mind works, please think of it as a form of aversion therapy. Earlier I mentioned that reality is in a state of constant flux, which is to say that everything is fresh and new in each moment. My tendency and yours to cling to judgments of good and bad and right and wrong, reasonable and unreasonable, does not alter the fact that everything is completely new all the time and completely free of our judgments. Recently, my habit of not allowing my mind to change with reality became quite obvious when I ran into a neighbor in the elevator of my building. Nearly 3 years ago, this neighbor entered the elevator on the day of the first Women's March. She entered the elevator, glared at me, and loudly demanded, "Where's your pussy hat?" I'm quoting her. I would never say such a thing without quoting someone. She then continued, "You've got to have a pussy hat," right in my face. There's a very small elevator. Scowling. Well, I was a little taken aback. I'd been at the Women's March and I was proud to support it, but I'm very finicky about hats. And pink is not my color, and I wasn't wild about the shape either, to be perfectly frank. My neighbor's bossiness wasn't sitting well with me. I told her, defiantly, I had no desire to wear that hat. Reality was right there at that moment, cheek by jowl with its boon companion, delusion. My neighbor had a hat and thought I should wear the same model. I had no hat and no intention of wearing the same model. We disagreed on what I should be doing. Rather than noticing how things actually were and asking ourselves why the way things were was actually a problem at all, we loudly agreed to suffer together. When I saw this neighbor in the elevator again a few days ago, the encounter 3 years before came back immediately. Years later, I couldn't and can't get that conversation out of my mind. My mind is stuck on that impression and always sees her through the lens of that disagreeable to me encounter about hats. And yet, she is not the same as she was on that day. I am not the same as I was on that day, and the Women's March is most certainly not the same as it was on that day. Everything has continually changed since that day. Right now, try to see everything as being fresh and new. look at me if you want, or somebody nearby you, and conduct this little experiment in meeting reality. Just look at me or someone else and see if you can see what you're looking at with complete impartiality. Look at the so-called person as if you've never seen a human being, much less the particular human being you're looking at now. You've never seen this thing we call a person in your entire life. You have no idea what you're looking at. Can you do that? Can you drop the story that you might have about the person you're looking at? Your resentment, your affection, your indifference? Can you forget about whether you find the person attractive or unattractive? If you train your eye on yourself with this kind of impartiality, what do you see there? If you really take your ideas out of the picture and relate directly to your own experience of reality, which is nothing other than yourself, what do you see? Is there anything there at all? The Vimalakirti Sutra says that bodhisattvas should regard living beings as a conjurer, looks upon the beings he conjures up. And that describes our problem perfectly. We conjure up what we see. We don't see. We allow our minds to tell us what they want to tell us. And that is what we call seeing. It's usually what we've seen again and again for years. It's our habit. What's actually in front of us is very hard to see because we keep forgetting that it is us. Regardless of the almost continual discomfort we feel as our ideas collide with what we're looking at, it doesn't change the fact that it is us. Getting back to why we're all here, let's say you think that meditating will make you a good person. You have an idea about what a good person is. But how do you know your idea is valid? What about when your idea of what a good person is highly different from the idea that someone else has about what a good person is? You and the person with whom you disagree are joined by legions of others who all have their idea of what a good person is. And it's really our ideas about what a good person is that is tearing this country apart right now. It's all just a matter of cultural conditioning, reinforced by our desire to protect ourselves and be right, at all costs to be right and safe. No matter how many people offer an opinion on this subject, there will never be any such thing as a good person or a bad person. There will never be any such thing as a person at all. The Vimalakirti Sutra approaches this through a dialogue between Manjushri, who's up there on the altar right there, and the rich and brilliant layman Vimalakirti. Manjushri asks him, "What is the root of good and not good?" Vimalakirti said, "The body is the root." Manjushri, "What is the root of the body?" Vimalakirti, "Desire and greed are the root." Manjushri, "What is the root of desire and greed?" "False and empty distinctions are the root." "What is the root of false and empty distinctions?" "Topsy-turvy thinking is the root." "What is the root of topsy-turvy thinking?" "Groundless assumptions are the root of topsy-turvy thinking." "What is the root of groundless assumptions?" "What is groundless can have no root." Makes sense, doesn't it? "It is on the root of this groundlessness that all the other concepts are built up." All our ideas are just built on a pile of sand. The tide comes in, the tide goes out. It all just kind of threatens constantly to topple over. And we're just constantly, constantly gathering this sand and trying to shore it all up. Can you see a person without what you call a person? Bimalakirti says we should see living beings as the wise view the moon in the water, or a face or form seen in a mirror, as shimmers of heat in a torrid season, as the echo that follows a cry. The Diamond Sutra, written not long afterwards, apparently, said the same thing. If Subhuti, the idea of a living being, occurs to a bodhisattva, he should not be called a bodhisattva. Why is that? Subhuti, anybody to whom the idea of a living being occurs, or the idea of a soul, or the idea of a person occurs, should not be called a bodhisattva. Well, should we be called bodhisattvas then? Arenkyo Roshi has a very generous definition of bodhisattvas, that a bodhisattva is an enlightening being. I really like that definition. And by that definition, there is not a single person on this planet who is not a bodhisattva. Everyone is included. And this is actually where the Vimalakirti Sutra is not for me as enlightened as it could be. It lists a lot of bodhisattvas, but their names mark them as superlative beings who are incapable of irritating anyone. And I really find that irritation is the most enlightening moment of all. So there's Bodhisattva Meditation Freedom King, Bodhisattva Dharma Freedom King, Bodhisattva Dharma Forms, Bodhisattva Constantly Raised Hand, Bodhisattva Jeweled Valor, Bodhisattva Bright Net, and so on. Not one of these guys is likely to get under your skin at all. So on my travels, I've connected with a different group of bodhisattvas whom I would like to acknowledge for the awakening that they have inspired in me through their bounty and mercy. Bodhisattva Bad Breath. Bodhisattva Incredibly Bad Breath. Bodhisattva Who Ignores Me on Purpose. Bodhisattva Getting Served Before Me Even Though She Was Seated After Me. Bodhisattva Never Returns My Calls. Bodhisattva Doesn't Hold the Elevator For Me. Bodhisattva Very Entitled. Bodhisattva Shouting Into His Cell Phone While Gesticulating Wildly at Nobody. I bow in homage to them all, as well as the bodhisattvas that I carry with me all the time. Bodhisattva Mr. Know-It-All. Bodhisattva Wanting to Control Everything All the Time. Bodhisattva Highly Defensive. Bodhisattva Not Trusting Self or Others. They're my favorites. They're the ones that got me here today. I bow to them all. So what is the solution to the difficulties we bodhisattvas create for ourselves and others with our made-up ideas and our warped yardsticks, judgmental yardsticks? What's the cure for this universal illness? The Vimalakirti Sutra says, once one has understood the origin of illness, one may do away with the thought of an I or an ego, and the thought of other living beings. To do so, one should call up the thought of phenomena, and then, in order to wipe out the thought of phenomena, the ailing bodhisattva should think to herself, this thought or concept of phenomena, too, is a form of upside-down thinking. I must rid myself of it by ridding myself of thoughts of I and mine, which means ridding myself of dualism, which means not thinking of phenomena as external or internal, but treating all as equal. Once one has acquired this kind of equal outlook, one will be freed of all other illness and will only have the illness of emptiness. And the illness of emptiness, too, is empty. Translation: all the mental energy we expend defending ourselves while determining how unsatisfactory things are and carping about how things should be is a total waste. If we stop separating from reality and approaching it as something separate from ourselves, if we start recognizing that it is us, all our suffering will immediately vanish. So simple to say, not so simple to do. Soon, we will have lunch together. And before eating, we will chant, "Second, as we receive this offering, we should consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it." While you consider whether your virtue and practice deserve it, and while you eat, perhaps you'll have a trace of this passage from the Vimalakirti Sutra lingering in your mind. Subhuti, if you cannot cut yourself off from lewdness, anger, and stupidity, and yet not be a part of these, if you can refrain from destroying the idea of a self and yet see all things as of a single nature, if you are willing to join hands with a host of devils and make the defilements your companion, if you can be no different from all these devils and dust and defilements, if you can bear hatred toward all living beings, slander the Buddhas, vilify the law, not be counted among the assembly of monks, and in the end never attain nirvana, if you can do all this, then you will be worthy to receive food. Is this speech by Vimalakirti reasonable or unreasonable? What can you do with this speech? I'd like to leave you with a poem, with apologies to Hoshinji in Obama, Japan, where it was written on a wall and it's been freely adapted from here. There is not a single thing. What then is there to eat? If rice and beans were to exist, from where would it arise? If you can truthfully answer these questions, then you may open your mouth and put something inside it. It is said that food is nourishing, but one must know that all our eating is empty. Even if you can eliminate immediately both time and space, at that point, you must taste it again.